Good morning, everyone. Gary Allen coming to you live from the studios of KNBR 680 San Francisco, high above the streets. On the program this morning, we're going to be talking about innovation, the whole art of innovation. On the program this morning, we have Tom Kelly, the general manager of IDEO, who's the author of The Art of Innovation, The 10 Faces of Innovation, and also an old friend of the program, Paul Wittke, who's the founder and CEO of the Alliance of Chief Executives. That's an organization that's exclusively for chief executives here in Northern California. So get your thinking caps on, and let's get rid of all of those barriers about thinking and really find out what happens out there, how to make things work. On the program this morning, we have Paul Wittke, who's the founder and CEO of the Alliance of Chief Executives. Paul, welcome back to the program. Pleasure to see you. I guess this weather, though, is a little bit of a downer, but how are things going?
Things are going great, Gary. Thanks for having me back.
Now, very quickly for the audience who may have missed some of your appearances previously, just give us the quick brief background of the organization that you head.
As you know, Gary, the Alliance of Chief Executives is really very simple. All we do is bring leaders together that run companies of virtually every type, every industry. Here in the Bay Area, we have several hundred CEOs that come together. And what we really do is we create environments which are really safe and confidential, where they can talk openly and candidly and really address their most confidential, most strategic challenges, and really look for ways to identify new ideas to grow their companies and new strategies.
And that's probably something that's very unique for CEOs out there, in the sense that when you have these men and women who are leading companies, they're at the top of the pyramid, and often they don't have a peer that they can feel that they can open up their innermost thoughts to. So is that one of the big driving forces that you see so many CEOs come into your organization?
Yes. What most people don't realize is the role of a CEO is very unique. They're actually people that are constantly scanning the universe for ideas, or how things are changing out there in the globalization and how the world is changing and new technology. And they're frankly quite paranoid about competitors and new threats, looking for new opportunities. But the challenge is that inside their own organizations, they have to be very clear and confident, and they can't talk about all the ideas and creative problems and things that are going through their brain. So if you create an environment where they can talk with other leaders that are seeing the world in many, many different ways, it's quite powerful.
And what you just brought up is exactly how I'm going to introduce the second guest this morning, which is all about innovation, ideas, thoughts, and how to make things happen. So it's a real pleasure to have on the program this morning Tom Kelly, who's the general manager of IDEO, who's also the author of The Art of Innovation and The 10 Faces of Innovation. And Tom, welcome to the program for the first time.
Thanks, Gary.
Now, let's talk a little bit about two things, first of all. First, the company, give us a little bit of background, and then we'll just delve into the world of innovation from that point forward.
Sure. IDEO is a design and innovation firm founded by my brother David about almost 30 years ago now in Palo Alto, and still headquartered here in the Bay Area.
Thanks for not moving offshore or wherever else, so we're happy about that.
There you go. No, we still got lots of people in San Francisco and Palo Alto. And so in the old days, we worked on products, and it was kind of easier to explain back then. We worked on the Apple Mouse. We worked on the Palm 5 personal digital assistant. We made those big electromechanical whales that were in the movie Free Willy, the kind of animatronic things.
So all these real staid things that aren't much fun,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. But in the last decade or two, we've expanded into services and physical spaces, and now we even work directly on company cultures using the same lessons that we learned from the original product design work. We now call it design thinking.
And that's when I was doing some of the research earlier this week about your company and the things that you do, I found it very fascinating because you don't look or feel like the typical company. Can you give us that flavor from an outsider looking in as to what it's about? And then we're going to take what you do internally and then look at it from the outside world, basically.
Sure. No, it's a really fun place to work. It's got a very kind of youthful culture, even with old guys like me around. It's a very idea-friendly environment. So people will never laugh at you if you come up with a really stupid or weird idea. They'll try to build on it.
That means myself and the guys behind the glass could fit in there then, because we've got stupid ideas all the time.
A lot of people have found their spiritual home there. It's just a fun place for people who are very curious, who like to share ideas and like to see their stuff implemented out in the real world.
Now, this whole concept of innovation itself, when you first pull away, let's say, the surface aspect of it, you're right. What I think about is new products. I think about maybe adding a new service to a company, etc. But the real concept that you're talking about here is innovation as truly a process, isn't it?
Sure. It's innovation as a core competency for companies, because we've all seen great companies that kind of fall on hard times because they slowed their pace of innovation. You know, I'm originally from Akron, Ohio, where there were these companies that ruled the tire industry worldwide. We're all based in Akron, Goodyear and Firestone, and those, and they just slowed their process of innovation and allowed other companies like Michelin and Bridgestone and others to take huge pieces of their market share. And so that's a part of what innovation is about, is staying competitive, catching up with, staying ahead of the competition.
Now, Paul, when you're looking at the organization that you're in, and from what your opening comments were about, you talk about innovation, obviously, and you talk about new ideas. How difficult is it for those CEOs to see that vision, and do they struggle with then implementing that aspect of it?
Well, the execution is always the key to success. But with CEOs that I work with are curious people that are looking at the world and always seeing ideas. And the bigger challenge they have is having to say no to so many different ideas so that they can focus their, because an organization can only focus on so many things at one time, so they have to choose the right ones that will truly differentiate themselves against the competition, be rewarded by customers, and give sustainable success.
Now, Tom, when you hear that, does that ring true from your world as well, where you're looking at innovation? Because I can tell you, as a business owner myself, we get new ideas almost every day, and it just seems like we get distracted by most of them.
Right. Well, there were two things that Paul said that were true to me. One is CEOs are pro-innovation. I love hanging around with CEOs because they tend to be visionaries. They tend to see what's possible. And in large organizations, the issues run into when the CEO hands off their kind of vision to a middle manager who says, okay, how am I going to actually make this
I've got
work?
Another project.
Right. But the other thing Paul said was true, too, which is from the CEO standpoint or from the middle manager standpoint as well, you do have to choose among the possibilities that are out there. And so our solution to that is find a way to prototype. Try out your ideas in a way that is cheaper and quicker than the competition is using. Because if you can experiment with more ideas, sure, you'll have some small failures, but you will learn at a faster rate and you'll have more successes because you were willing to try more things.
So that's interesting. So what you're saying is with these larger organizations that obviously have the resources to do this, they can take a few people and put them in charge of something. So these are limited scale, let's try it out or test the waters?
Right. Let's test it any way we can. You know, Bank of America used to be headquartered here, now somewhere on the East Coast. They prototype new banking services live in front of their customers in their Atlanta branches. But they only run the experiment for 1 or 2 weeks. So it's not very expensive, and they're testing always for one very specific thing. Can you distract people from waiting in line if you run a video screen? And then they learn from things. But if you think of an experiment as you've got to take something all the way to market, and, you know, gee, that sounds expensive, we can only do 1 or 2 of those a year, well, then you have fewer innovation. But if you think of an experiment as quick and cheap and say, like, okay, let's test that out.
Now, Paul, when we take a look at, let's call it the environment of today, the business environment today, it's obviously very, very apparent now that things move much faster than they used to. Is that also important for CEOs to be able to jump on these ideas and talk to them? So, in other words, you can't take 3-4 years anymore to just think about something, can you?
No, it's the world is just changing so much faster. I mean, nowadays, if some 20-year-old entrepreneur in some small corner of the world comes up with a new idea, and it works, the rest of the world knows about it within days or if not hours or minutes. So the urgency to innovate and stay up to speed and create sustainable advantages is really keeping CEOs awake at night.
Now, and Tom, this brings up the whole point that you were talking about, and that has to do with this whole thing of trying to, you know, have a good idea, keep it in-house, keep it secret as long as you can, I guess for at least half a day or 2 days or 3 days. How do you make sure that a company is in a position to, okay, they've identified this idea that they have, they're going to go through the quick test, how do they make sure they keep it in the front and they're on that bleeding edge, per se?
Sure. Well, I mean, what we're really talking about, I think, is the pace of innovation.
Yes.
Is about keeping you're, you know, so you try one thing and then you try another and you try another. A local company here I think is great at that is Charles Schwab and Company, mm-hmm. right? They had some failures. They
yes.
tried some gadgets, some ways of monitoring your portfolio, but they kept going. And we actually have an expression for this need to keep the pace up. We call it the Red Queen effect. You may have read to your kids that Alice Through the Looking Glass story where they're trying to get across the chessboard and Alice is there with the Red Queen and they're running, but they're not getting anywhere. And this is bugging the heck out of Alice. And she says to the Red Queen, hey, you know, what's up with this? Why aren't we going forward? And the Red Queen turns to Alice kind of impatiently and says, oh, Alice, you want to get somewhere, you got to run twice as fast as that. And so that's where all my clients are these days. Not enough to be an innovator. You can't just come up with an innovation once a year. It's not enough. You got to outpace the innovation of a lot of pretty world-class companies based around the world. So it's that sort of spirit, that culture of continuous innovation that's going to keep companies successful.
This morning, folks, we're visiting with Tom Kelly. He's the general manager of IDEO, and we also have Paul Whitkay, who's the founder and CEO of the Alliance of Chief Executives. If you haven't figured it out in the first 15 minutes, we're talking about innovation today. We're talking about ideas. We're talking about how corporations, how executives, how individuals from top to bottom can be innovative and have these ideas, and all that and much more straight ahead on Northern California's number one business talk show, Gary Allen on Business on KNBR 680, the business and sports leader. On the program this morning, we have Paul Whitkay. He's the founder and CEO of the Alliance of Chief Executives. And also we have Tom Kelly, who is the general manager of IDEO. And just before the break, we were starting to talk about the whole, I guess, the atmosphere of where things are these days in the sense of innovation, et cetera. Let's assume now, and I'll start with you, Tom, and that's the whole concept of you get an inquiry from an outside company, and I'm assuming that's the way it happens, that, hey, we're interested in innovating. How do you go about kind of, let's just say, kicking the tires to find out how the company is doing currently, and then are they a good candidate for a nice incubator of innovation?
Sure. I think the deal with innovation, it's kind of like the Supreme Court says, I know it when I see it. It's pretty clear. Even if you don't have quantitative metrics in your head. You go here in the Bay Area, if you go over to Emeryville and visit Pixar, you go mm-hmm. down to Mountain View and visit Google or Cupertino and visit Apple, you know it's an innovative company. And then you go, I won't name any companies.
You don't have to
but
name
you go
any,
to the other kind, you can tell right away.
And Gary, if I can add, when you walk into IDEO headquarters, it's exactly the same type of energy you walk in, and it's just creativity, you know, exudes out their pores.
So it's a buzz that you just kind of, it's kind of, let's call it the gut check when you walk in, and it's that first feeling that you get, so that when you walk in, and let's just say it doesn't look like the traditional ivory tower with a person with a dour look behind the front counter saying, may I help you? I mean, it's that feeling that you don't get, right?
Yeah, if Dilbert works there, it's probably not an innovative company.
That's perfect in that sense. Now, how do companies, though, if they feel that they're pretty good at innovating, how do they kind of do the check and find out, hey, how do we improve upon things?
Sure. I mean, there's lots of small things you can do. One way is just to listen to the language that people use. Because, for example, if I come up with an idea and offer it up to you, of course, there's always something wrong with an idea. And so do people jump on it and play the devil's advocate and say, oh, that'll never work because that's too expensive? Or do they say, well, I'm not sure it'll work in that form, but if you changed it this way, maybe it would have more promise. So if you've got an organization where people are building on ideas as opposed to, I don't know, scoring points for being the clever critic of an idea, that's certainly one tiny element in a culture of innovation.
And this is not to pick on him, but I believe the guy's name was Chainsaw Al Dunlap. So what you're saying is he would normally not be on top of an innovative culture.
Is sure.
That, yeah, and he was brought in
to be the hatchet guy.
To be a hatchet guy, and sometimes that's necessary to do a restart
sure.
the company so you can start to grow again. So,
so maybe there's a question for both of you in that sense. If we're talking about innovation today, give me the prototypical CEO that would be a good person on top of innovation in that sense. So either one of you wants to jump in on that one.
CEO, sounds like you.
Oh, there's lots. One, as driving in here this morning, going to the business and sports leader, I was actually thinking of one of our own Bay Area leaders that was we recently passed away, and Bill Walsh of the 49ers sure. is clearly an innovator. And I think he also epitomized the way that most people think of him as the West Coast offense, which, frankly, I think Bill would say he wasn't the creator of the West Coast offense. He learned from many of his mentors, Sid Gilman and others, and Paul Brown and
Bob Bronson, and there's a few others. Yep, exactly.
And collaborated, but he had an incredibly creative mind. But it was just as important was all the other things he looked at, innovating the 49ers into an organization that hadn't existed before. The way the drafted players created the organization, the practice schedules, they didn't kill their players in the August training camp, so they'd be fresh in December. The way they traveled as a team. He looked at every single detail of that organization, how they did things to create a winning organization. That's an innovative leader.
Yeah, I think another thing would be how they approach talent. You know, because a truly self-confident CEO is constantly trying to hire people smarter than he or she is, right? If they lack that confidence, they're trying to hire people they can control. But if you try to hire people smarter than you, you end up with a really great organization. In my current book, The 10 Phases of Innovation, one of the chapters is called The Director. And if you think about a great Hollywood director or a great stage director on Broadway, they don't take the stage. They're not trying to make themselves famous. They're trying to find the most talented, creative people they can have and let them shine, let them perform. And so that's a kind of a good metaphor for the best of the CEOs out there.
So now let me ask you this, because you know I'm sure some people out there right now are saying, well, you know what, I'm just not an innovator. It's not in me. It's not in my blood. So like your book, The Art of Innovation, The 10 Phases, et cetera, all those types of things, how would the average person who maybe right now is looking at the world with the, you know, the glass half empty versus half full, are the books designed to help them get into that mind, that state of mind that will help them to identify this and move forward and grow and become creative?
Sure, absolutely. I typically make the distinction between creativity and innovation, because when people hear the word creative,
yes.
It sounds like a characteristic that you're either born with or you develop during childhood. Whereas innovation sounds, I think, a bit more like something you can acquire. And so I focus more on the innovation side than on the creativity side. And the thing about innovation is it's so big, it's really hard to get your arms around if you start to kind of tackle it all at once. But if you break it down into component parts, it's kind of like a golf swing. They say there are 17 elements in the perfect golf swing. And it's really, really hard to do them all at once.
I only do two or three of them, so I'm still working on that aspect of it.
Right, but if you break it down to its component elements, so we think innovation, you know, some of the things I've mentioned, an idea-friendly environment, a CEO or a leader that has an interest in attracting creative talent. But there are lots of other elements. Well, my book is called The 10 Phases of Innovation. It's really the 10 ingredients in the recipe for innovation. You look at the individual ingredients, like being an anthropologist, you know, observing human behavior more carefully. Hey, anybody can do that. And if you do each of the ingredients well, gee, pretty soon you're an innovator.
Now, one thing I always ask all the authors that I talk to on the program is can you describe to us when was that light bulb moment where you said, I need to write a book on this? And how did that come about?
Sure. Mine was a very distinct moment. We had great fun with a TV show almost 10 years ago now. We were on Ted Koppel's Nightline show. It ran on February 9th. And on February 10th, I got a call from a literary agent in New York who said, hey, Tom, ever think about writing a book? And I said, yeah, the thought had crossed my mind, but I work with my brother, and my brother had said, gee, you know, that sounds like a lot of time away from the office. And
wait a minute, your brother now, the innovator, was saying, hey, this can't work? Or
well, no, he was just raising an issue. We eventually overcame that issue, and I did the first book entirely nights and weekends.
Really?
It took me 2 years, nights and weekends, but I wrote The Art of Innovation that way. And then the second one was easier because people actually believed that I could write a book the second time. It was the first time. It was just Tom's little hobby off on the side. Some people play golf. Tom's writing a book.
Now, many people, even listeners of this program, they all dream about maybe writing a book at some point. And when you're writing part-time like that and you're innovating basically your story here, how often did you have to go back and rewrite? Because, as you say, it took 2 years. So when you write something in January of this year and you look at it January of next year when you've moved on in the book and you go, wow, that doesn't work, I got to rewrite that. So how much of a process was it?
Well, you write every paragraph about four times. When I finished the, quote, manuscript, and shipped it off to the publisher, I thought, oh, that's just such a wonderful feeling. I'm done. And I wasn't close to done. I'd worked on it every Saturday for more than a year. I worked every Saturday and Sunday during the rewrites. So, yes, you have to go through everything a few times. And then worse, a traditional book, a business book, it's 9 months from when you write the last word until it shows up in a bookstore. So during those 9 months, the world changes, and you do regret a word or two in the book, even the first day it's in a bookstore.
Go ahead real quick. And
I was just going to say, it is a great book. I recently read The 10 Phases of Innovation, and it's a great example of how the individual genius that people think of that creates new ideas really is a myth. And Tom's book does talk about all the different roles that are played in the creativity process and innovation process that, when they come together, actually create an innovative new product or service, and different roles that people play.
And that's what we're going to talk about. Right after the break, we're going to talk about the fact that most people think about innovation as a new product or a new something. And it's really a much bigger idea or picture that we're going to talk about. On the program this morning, we have Paul Wittke. He's the founder and CEO of the Alliance of Chief Executives. Also on the program, it's a real pleasure to have Tom Kelly, who's the general manager of IDEO. And they are really, let's call it the heart and soul of innovation, at least the concepts, the ideas here in the United States and also worldwide. Because just give us a quick background, if you can. I know, obviously, you can't say every client that you have, but what are some of the interesting things that you've worked on over the past years with your organization?
Sure. We're stretched a little bit around the world now. We're in Munich and Shanghai and London and things like that. And so...
Are you saying maybe that innovation is a worldwide thing and not just here?
You betcha. Well, in fact, I spoke in 16 different countries last year. I mean, in Istanbul, they're interested in innovation. So yeah, it is definitely a worldwide thing. But so we're working on all kinds of things. As far as things that the audience may have experienced, we work with Bank of America on the Keep the Change program, this checking account that rounds up to the nearest dollar. We work with Procter & Gamble on the Neat Squeeze toothpaste tube, the stand-up toothpaste tube. And so most people either have some object we worked on or are using some service that we've been associated with.
Now, it's interesting because you brought up some products there, but we also want to talk about innovation in the greater sense of the term and the idea. So innovation isn't just about coming out with the next great widget, is it? It's more of an overall, let's just call it, it's an experience for an organization, isn't it? It's a mindset.
Sure, that's exactly the right word. It's a mindset. It's an approach to the world that says, okay, there's going to be changes. We're not going to focus on the past and dig in our heels and try to resist change. We're going to embrace it. We're going to use innovation as the way that our company gets ahead and our employees do well and things like that. And
so unlike some of my college professors when I was going in the late 70s, early 80s. That were showing me ideas and thoughts about the Great Depression, that's no longer probably the best way to innovate, is it?
Right. In fact, if you asked earlier about analyzing corporate cultures, if you see cultures that talk a lot about nostalgia for the past as opposed to enthusiasm for the future, that's one tell. That's one indication of the kind of culture that you have. And so the innovators are always thinking about the future. And sure, there are great things about the past, but they're saying, okay, what's our strategy for what's sometimes called a flat world in which we're competing every day against India and China?
Now, this is probably the biggest softball question of the morning, and there's a few in here, but how important is innovation to an organization from both of your standpoints? So we'll start with Paul. How do you think innovation stands up there if you had the list of five?
I think any companies that don't innovate on some dimension are going to die. They just can't stay stagnant because their competition is constantly looking for new ways to improve their services, to lower their costs, to attract better employees, to create better profits for their investors. They're constantly looking for ways to improve. And when you stop finding ways to improve, you may as well get out of the business and go home.
Yeah, and the CEOs of the world agree with this. There's a recent Boston Consulting Group survey of CEOs where they asked them, what's on your strategic agenda? It wasn't multiple choice. They didn't give them a list of things to choose from. They just said, what's on your strategic agenda?
That's always a cop-out, by the way, isn't it, when you give people five choices? I mean, you've pretty much, by giving them the five choices, you've kind of framed the entire process, haven't
you? Exactly. So they asked this open-ended question of the CEOs of the world, and 85% of them put innovation on their top three of the topics they reported on.
And so that wasn't industry-specific then. That was across the board.
Across industries and across the world. And so clearly it is on people's minds. And you know, as Paul said, innovate or die, one of our local clients at Specialized Bicycle down in Morgan Hill, they actually bought a big black hearse. And in about 12-inch letters, in white letters on this black hearse, they wrote innovate or die. And they took it to all their big bicycle events and drove it around just as a reminder that you got to keep moving forward.
Now, let's talk about how you move forward here because we talked a little bit earlier in the program about this, and that's that whole concept of there are ideas popping up in front of CEOs and inside organizations every single day. And it's just like news and any other, the internet. How do you get rid of all this noise and focus on the one or two or three things a year that may make a big difference for an organization?
Well, I frankly think that is the role of the CEO or the leaders in the company to really frame the vision of who that company is, what they stand for, and what dimensions of innovation they're looking for. And the company that comes to mind there that's the best example would be Southwest Airlines. There was no room for an upstart airline at the time they started, I think about 30, 40 years ago. The other airlines were quite powerful. But Herb Keller said, we're going to be the low cost, we're going to be friendly, and we're going to be on time. And he didn't care about ideas for better food. He didn't care about innovation in a lot of the different dimensions. But if it helped reduce the cost for their customers to fly, made it friendlier so they could attract employees who liked working there and would work for less money than the workers at the other airlines, and would help them turn those planes around on time, those are the things he was interested in and focused their attention on innovating in those areas.
You know, it's interesting to see that because if you think about Southwest, the things that they innovated on, many of the, let's call it the traditional airlines, have moved more towards that business model. So you can obviously tell history says they were right.
Well, they're far more profitable, and they continue to innovate. I was just reading the paper this morning about tweaking the way they have people queue up in lines to get on airplanes. So they're constantly looking for, is there a better way of doing this to meet those three core values.
And I'll be honest with you, because I fly Southwest a lot, I'm sure you guys do, because they go all over the place and it's pretty short hop, you might as well jump on. I think they got it right because most people like the fact that you can pick your own seat. What they didn't like about that process was having to stand in line an hour and a half early, and now that they're going to say, hey, you can come, you've got your A boarding pass, but your number one, the number actually means something at this point, and they eliminated the bad part. So innovation at its best, I think.
But the risk is that once you standardize on a particular dimension, on the airplanes they have and the way of doing business and the routes they have, it creates opportunities for new competitors.
That's right.
When they have new airplanes that are more fuel efficient or putting in video screens and sell advertising off of Google, something that different additional revenue sources. There's constantly competitors that are trying to improve on the Southwest model, even if they're still copying it.
And yep. That's one of the things, Tom, is for you is and you think about this whole concept. It's not just a let's call it a snapshot in time. It's a process that goes on forever, doesn't it?
Sure, absolutely. And you know, Paul was talking about risk, which I always find to be an interesting topic because some companies believe that you know innovation is risky. You know, we're gonna play it safe. We're gonna stick with the status quo. And the airline example you mentioned is a perfect one because all the big airlines, the Uniteds and the Americans of the world, stuck with the old system. We're gonna stick with hub and spoke. We're gonna be a full service airline because that's the safe way to go. And they stayed safe. In their mind, while Southwest went off and took 100% of the profit in the industry for the last decade or so, and now United and others are kind of climbing out of the basement. But in the long run, sticking with the status quo is not the safe option. That's darned risky. Innovation is the safe option. You want to be you want to be an employee of the company that's innovative, not of the one that's trying to marry itself to the past.
Now, here's the tough question then for you. And Paul, this is specifically geared at you because you work with so many CEOs. The safe option is to continue to maximize those profits for the short period of time. How important is it, though, for the CEO who may only be there 3, 4, 5, 6 years to not just keep the profits the same, but is willing to risk the bet on the company so that in the future, when that person's not there as the CEO, that success continues?
Well, I don't know what you're talking about when you talk about the safe option. Andy Grove of Intel wrote the book, Only the Paranoid Survive. And you just, it's risky to stay, more risky to stay the same. But innovating on new products, new services, not knowing how your customers are going to react to it, knowing how the employees are going to change, and as Google gets older, they have all these really bright 20-year-old people right now. Well, 30 years from now, are those same people going to be working there? Is the company going to be the same? They're going to change as well, hopefully for the better. But there is no safe option in business these days. You've got to innovate or die, and hopefully you get it right. But if you have a good leader that is clear on the focus attention, and you keep trying, and it's like Tom said, simple cheap ways to experiment and just try things, see what works, what doesn't work, that's a way of just continually moving forward.
That's the answer I was looking for, because I hear so many people out there say, you know what, we'd like to try new products, we'd like to try new markets, but we just can't afford to take that risk. And I hear that a lot from a lot of, let's call it, less than enlightened leaders, because they're really running more scared from the competition than essentially creating the competition. Does that make sense? Do you guys see that at all? I mean, probably in your organization, no, because you have a lot of very progressive CEOs, but I do see that out there from these folks.
Well, the challenge is, in certain areas, I mean, you can't have the entire business continually experimenting. You do have to have a core business that is profitable, that enables cash flow to fund the growth ideas so you can continually experiment. Google has its incredibly profitable search engine business right now, and they're still trying to find where the other businesses of the future are going to be. Now, I think they're going to find them because they're incredibly creative, but that search engine business is driving it, and will that still be driving as much profit 10 years from now as it is today?
Now, let me ask you this, and you guys may not agree with this, and let's take Google and let's talk Microsoft.
Uh-huh.
You look at Microsoft, the operating system obviously has been driving that company for 30 years, and that's their bread and butter, and they've tried to find these other innovations, some successful, some not. Do you see some of the same type of tendencies, or let's call it life cycle, for Google in that instance, because they've dominated a marketplace where they are, and now they're looking for the next big hit? Is there some analogy to that, or are these organizations so different, so completely opposite apples and oranges, it's wrong?
Well, Microsoft's been at it for so long that it's almost unfair to compare them in a way. Google's much newer kid on the block, but I have more familiarity with Google than with Microsoft, and they are just conducting so many experiments that I believe they're going to find new stuff. They've got this 20% rule. You know, 3M for decades has had this deal for certain people that you can spend as much as 15% of your time on some unstructured problem that might, you know, bear fruit for the company. At Google, it's 20%. And so you just go, if you click on the More button at Google, you'll see they're trying new stuff every day. And I think that will contribute to the long-run success of the organization. I think Paul is right. 20 years from now, they will look completely different than they look today. But I'm really encouraged by the rate of experimentation that they are doing.
We're visiting this morning with Paul Wittke. He's the founder and CEO of the Alliance of Chief Executives, and Tom Kelly, who's the general manager of IDEO. Companies in general are always constantly looking for, it's a degree of innovation in the sense of trying to find out how to, you know, cut the cost of a widget and how to manufacture things quicker or how to make the customer experience a little better. All those little minor tweaks. Have you seen, though, when we talk about the big idea, and it all comes in grades of shades of gray, et cetera, the big changing events for companies per se? Is there a way to incubate that? Is it all by luck and chance? Or, you know, is it the whole thing of luck is nothing more than being prepared and making it happen?
No, I don't think it's luck at all. I think you can have a systematic process for finding those big innovations. And the first step in that process is getting away from your desk. Because we believe that customers will not help you with the big idea. They will not send you questions or raise their hand and say, you know what I need? Because what they need is something a little smaller, a little cheaper, a little better. But the breakthroughs, we think, are going to come from observing humans. You're observing your customers and not asking them. So one small example of that would be, oh, about 10 years ago, Oral-B asked us to take a look at kids' toothbrushes. And everybody knows what kids' toothbrushes are, and everybody knows that kids have smaller hands than their parents, so they need a parent's toothbrush scaled down. But when we swapped into this anthropology role that we use in all of our work, we noticed something right away. We noticed that kids, they don't hold the toothbrush in their fingertips the way their parents do. They kind of fist it. They just grab a hold of it. And as soon as we saw that, we said, hey, look at that. What does that mean? And what it meant was, instead of skinny little toothbrushes, let's make fat, squishy toothbrushes. And sure, those were copied for a while, but our client, Oral-B, had the best-selling kids' toothbrush in the world for a while because we made this discovery about the way a kid brushes their teeth just by observing.
And that's something that you see often in many industries, isn't it, where all the, let's call it the propeller head thinkers are going, this is the way it's going to work. And then when a product is introduced out into the public, it's not often like it is on the drawing board, is it?
I agree totally with Tom. I think it is the CEOs I work with, the best ones know that they don't know it all. Frankly, they come with far, far more questions than they have answers. And it is getting out in the world with a curious mind and thinking they can learn from anybody in any situation. But there was a great book written by Franz Johansson called The Medici Effect, that when you talk about breakthrough ideas and when you get out into a diverse situation where you're dealing with people in different cultures and different technologies, different markets, different industries that think totally different. And that's how the greatest innovative time in our history was created, the Renaissance by the Medici family, by bringing together the best thinkers and scientists and leaders and politicians and philosophers all in one place and create an environment where they could just talk to each other. That's where the breakthrough ideas, the game-changing things happen when you take technologies and ideas from one thing and apply it to another and vice versa, and it's all additive. And you never know quite where that one light bulb moment was, because it's a collaborative effect that all of a sudden the world's changed and you're not even quite sure how it got there.
And Tom, do you think that's important for companies? Because if you try to be too formulaic, doesn't that really stifle the innovative process?
Yeah, I met Franz Johansson in Australia a few weeks ago, and what he would say is, look, don't just set out saying, I'm going to hire the world's smartest engineer. Well, it's really hard to hire the world's smartest engineer. But what Franz would say
expensive.
Is... expensive. Yeah, that too. But what he would say is...
That was the CEO speaking for a moment.
True. But what Franz would say is, look, get a great engineer and an anthropologist and an economist and a business person in the room, and then you've got the best mix or a unique mix, maybe, of multiple disciplines. And that's where the Renaissance metaphor comes in, is you bring a bunch of different types of people together and suddenly sparks are flying. Suddenly you can come up with stuff that maybe is new to the world.
Now let me ask you this. You get this round table like we're sitting in here this morning, 5-6 brilliant people, at least a couple of you guys are. I'm just at the table watching. But the point being here is that you get these folks together. They're innovative. They're brilliant. Do you have to have people looking and watching and seeing what they're doing? Because sometimes the ideas might fly right by them and they don't really see the forest through the trees per se.
Well, in brainstorming sessions, when we've got a bunch of creative people in the room, somebody's the scribe. Somebody's capturing all the ideas. In fact, we don't want the individual participants to be taking notes. We want them to be fully engaged in the ideation process. But the scribe is writing down every idea that comes out. And then as soon as the brainstorming session is over, then there's a kind of a review process where you try to figure out what was a good idea, what's an idea worth pursuing, and which ideas are the wild ones that you want to toss away later. But that scribe does capture things in the way that we mentioned.
I think there's a leadership role there in focusing the attention on something, whether it's a problem or an opportunity, where it's almost impossible to put people in a room and then say, just come up with a brilliant idea. Change the world. Come up with a new service we can sell for a lot of money. It just doesn't work that way. However, if you get them together and say...
That sounds like the writer's block syndrome. You know, if you focus on, I got to get this paragraph done, it doesn't happen.
But if you focus their attention on making a better toothbrush for kids... and they start playing with it and seeing what's wrong and observing kids using it and just having fun with it. But a real focus on this is what we're trying to improve. I see it every day where where CEOs, where they start thinking about a different vertical market or a different or a problem that could be solved, they start seeing things and talking about things, and the world just opens up when they focus their attention like a laser beam on one particular area. You have to focus the attention somewhere. You can't just say, hey, come up with a brilliant idea.
Guys, we're up right against about 2 minutes left in the program. Couple of things that I want to do here. First of all, I want to thank both of you for coming in. So, Paul and Tom, thank you very much for coming in and sharing part of your Saturday morning. I know you're both very busy gentlemen. The second thing is I know that, Tom, you've been agreed to give away one of your books on the program this morning. So the number is 808-KNBR. That's 808-5627 for the Alphabetically Challenged on a Saturday morning. So that's 808-KNBR, 808-5627. Let's give it away for caller number 12 this morning. Caller number 12, 808-KNBR. That's 808-5627. Tom, in the last 25, 30 seconds, just a quick commercial. Where can they find the book? If they want to find out more about your company, what should they do?
Sure. They can find the book on Amazon. I have a website. It's www.10facesofinnovations. That's 10 spelled out. It's in all the places that you would normally find
the usual suspects for books.
Betcha.
And now, Paul, the whole concept in 20 seconds, Alliance of CEOs, what's the where can they find out more?
Well, if they're interested in running a company, we'd be happy to talk with them. They can find us at allianceofceos.com or call me personally at 925-942-2400.
And last 10, 15 seconds, innovation. How does it happen? Give us the whole concept in 30 seconds or less.
Just got to be willing to get out there and try stuff. It's a little scary at first. We actually suggest people start with a series of brainstorming sessions just to get people energized. But once you start, it can be really fun.
Guys, thanks very much for having you on the program this morning. Hopefully we'll have you on soon once again.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Folks, you've been listening to Gary Allen on Business on KNBR 680, the business and sports leader. We'll be back on next week, so have fun on this weekend. Bye-bye.